Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. We're live at 2 p.m. Eastern here on Wednesday, January 26th, 2022. Your host, Jim Masters. We're very excited to have author Katherine Johnson with us. She has penned this extraordinary novel called Grit and Granite. This novel is a fictionalized account of a real-life event that set her father and his partner against one of the largest and most powerful corporations in the United States. And the story tells of her father's fight against corporate greed and ambition to protect his client's legacy and his widow's fortune. The battle also created collateral damage of despair, disappointment, and disillusionment in his own family. Was the fight worth the cost, or did he win the battle but lose the most important treasure of all, his family? And the author, Katherine Johnson, grew up in a small town in Minnesota before relocating to Central Florida in the early 70s. This is her first novel, and currently she lives in suburban Washington, D.C., where she runs her own consulting firm, Johnson Consulting Group, which she specializes in developing and evaluating energy-efficient programs and policies for electric and gas utilities in North America. Ironically, her hometown sports team was nicknamed the Kilowatts. Really a riveting story, Grit and Granite. I think you're going to be moved by the conversation we have. While she's developed this successful consulting career, the novel has been a passion of hers for 25 years. And she truly believes, as folks, you know, have read it, they're actually drawn to the characters that she's created and the story that she's told. And it really is fantastic. It tells this David versus Goliath tale, but it also does capture the family dynamics and turmoil between the two characters, Colin and Ruth, where their dreams collide. It was a pretty exciting childhood, to say the least, she says, where phones were tapped and had lots of drama mixed in with a vibrant family dynamic. Her novel has shortlisted for several literary prizes, including finalist for literary and contemporary fiction finalist, notable 100 Indies, and finalist for the Silver Falchion Award, which is exciting as well. She's also launching an audiobook, which was narrated by Dallas Eskew, who did a fantastic job bringing the characters to life. And we're excited about this. She's actually going to share with us some pieces and elements from Grit and Granite as well. She's live and direct, coming to us from Frederick, Maryland. My special guest for the next 30 minutes here on Close Up Radio, author Katherine Johnson. Katherine, thank you very much for joining us here on the show. It's a real pleasure to have you. Congratulations
on
the book.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you so much. Yes, it's a lot of fun to finally get it out in the world, and people are reading it and they like it. So that's most important of all. So it's been a lot of fun, but it's been a long journey.
Yes, I was mentioning a 25-year journey. Tell us about the early nuggets of inspiration for you, Katherine, that sort of put things in motion for this book for you in terms of actually writing it, starting it. What was that like, and what were some of the things that inspired you to actually move in that direction, to put this all down on paper?
Well, it was, as I said, it was an interesting childhood, and my parents, who are the main characters in the book, did not shield us from any of the turmoil that was going on in the world. And so we were heightenedly aware of what was happening. My father, the character in the book, is named Colin Ford. He was a very happy, you know, small-town lawyer, and he gets the opportunity of a lifetime. But to go work for a philanthropist who was going to run a charitable foundation, and he was going to be helping doing good works. And he said, my dad was a lawyer. The character's a lawyer. There are good lawyers out there. And he really loved real estate law and probate law. And being a county attorney was fine, but, you know, he had bigger ambitions. So when he gets this opportunity to take this new job and this new position, it means it's a direct conflict with his wife, who all of her life had been searching for a home and a small town in the community that she lived in. So throughout my entire childhood, I kept hearing about the conflicts and witnessing the conflicts between my parents, and that is a huge feature in the book about how Colin wants to pursue his dreams, but it's at Ruth's expense. And how do they reconcile, and do they reconcile? And that's sort of the one of the main themes of what happens if you have to, what happens when your dreams collide with somebody you're married to and you have children. That's a lot of stuff going on in a house.
Now,
so that was
Colin
one part
Ford,
of it.
Yeah, and I was going to say the dreams sort of turned into a nightmare right after escaping the confines
exactly.
of small town law.
Yes, he did. What happened was my father, well, I'll talk about the book because otherwise I'll keep it too weird. So in the book, the hero, Colin Ford, takes his dream job. But before he takes the dream job, he takes his family on this very magical trip to the Magic Kingdom out in Anaheim, California in the 1960s. And, it's his way of saying, hey, look what a great life we're going to have. I'm going to be able to do things like this because I'm going to be paid a lot more money, and it's a great job, and I'm all excited. And, of course, the two characters, they have daughters, 6 and 9, and the 9-year-old and the 6-year-old are thrilled about being at the Magic Kingdom. Who wouldn't be, right? Disneyland, the happiest place on earth. Unfortunately, the visit gets cut short because after the first day, Colin gets a call, and that's what I'll read about, an excerpt, where he finds out that the man who hired him just died, and there's a lot of unfinished business. And so what he thought he was stepping into was completely opposite of what he ended up stepping into. And he never imagined that when he took this dream job, it would become a lawsuit, having to protect the assets of the widow, having to outsmart people that wanted to control a $300 million foundation, and never dreamed that that was what was going to happen. And that drama, that realization of, oh, this isn't what I thought I was going to have my life turn out to be, made for a lot of interesting moments in my childhood, and it really made me respect the people who resist temptation and the people who stand up for good. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I thought, we need stories about good guys who actually win sometimes.
Yes, we really do. So Colin thinks he's going to work for his favorite client, a wealthy philanthropist, and his wife, Evelyn Hughes, but instead of focusing on charitable good works, he must now fight to protect his client's legacy and Evelyn's fortune mm-hmm. from corporate greed and ambition. That really takes us – I mean, this is like a fast-paced legal thriller set in
it
a
is.
Rural
it is.
Midwestern town,
it is.
Huh?
Yeah, it is. And people say it's a fast read. In fact, one of my friends just bought the book, and she cut her dinner invitation short to go home and finish it. And I'm like, really? So because it does sort of suck you in. You think you're starting a story about this nice Midwestern family and these nice, ambitious, lawyer who has, pretty much charted out life. And then all of a sudden you realize that the people who the philanthropist thought were his very best friends, the people he had worked with for 30, 40 years, the minute he died, they turned on him. They turned on the widow. They wanted to take control of $300 million and direct the money in ways that would benefit their corporation and their politics. And unfortunately, it was a true story. And that was a sort of the notion of who would ever think that a philanthropy could be misused in that way and could and the character, the philanthropist, it's basically was kind of rags to riches. He left home because he couldn't stay on the farm because he had hay fever, and he went and started this very successful company with his partner. And he never imagined that upon his death, his partner would turn on him and turn on his wife and really try to usurp his power. And so that's where my father's character, Colin Ford, comes in and says, wait, we can stop it. We can figure it out. And they came up with a different idea. But it was very difficult to imagine having your best friends turn on you. And then, of course, the widow was this frail 5'2" little lady who had no idea that her husband's best friends would all of a sudden try to steal everything from her.
Really something. I mean, it's amazing. The conflict, as I mentioned in the beginning, really creates sort of this collateral damage of the despair, the disappointment, the disillusionment within the family. And that happens a lot, you know, more than we think when there is, you know, a passing in the family or just something happens and there's money and business and items and just all of this and estate all involved. You start to see, you know, what people are really like, sometimes even within a family, when all of these high stakes are in front of everybody, right?
Right. Well, exactly. And the other thing that was really, really surprising is because there was so much money at stake, and in 1960, $300 million was more than the Kennedys. It's a lot of money.
Yes.
And the widow, she had her own money too. So not only did they want the $300 million from Mr. Hughes's estate, they also wanted her $120 million. So there was the amount of greed was unfathomable. And that was sort of one of the heartbreaking parts, I think, for my character and my father in life, was to realize that some people, all they cared about was the money, and the characters, all Mr. and Mrs. Hughes really wanted to do was set up charitable foundations and give their money away, because they recognized that they had done very well in life and they wanted to help other people, and that was going to be thwarted by people who wanted to spend money to help the corporations and make sure the laws were passed the way they wanted it, and to really usurp, and corporate greed became an issue. And it's sort of interesting as a child kind of figuring out that, wow, you know, I didn't know people were like that. And certainly was a moment of reckoning for me. But when I wrote the story, I wanted people to also hear the story that, yes, but not everybody succumbs to those temptations. And my character, my dad, could have been a small-town lawyer, but he certainly outsmarted a lot of people. And he went on to really get a very good ending and resolution. So that's, you know, it's a story about how you can triumph over evil, which I think is, you can never hear that enough.
Yeah, really. It's so true. I mean, what are some things you learned along the way that surprised you? Because, again, this really is, which makes this fantastic, and again, we're talking to author Katherine Johnson of Grit and Granite, this incredible novel, fast-paced legal thriller set in a rural Midwest town. But really, it ties into this roller coaster ride that filled your childhood. So what are some things that you learned that surprised you as well as you, in this fictional account of a real-life event, put this whole thing in motion via the book? What are some things that really were like, I didn't realize this, as you were doing, you know, your research, creating the characters for the book, but you did all of this research to put the story together?
Right. Well, I think what surprised me the most was how my father, the character Colin Ford, was trying so hard to be a good attorney and a good, you know, do his responsibilities to the widow. And he was sort of, that's what Mr. Hughes told him to do, is he had to take care of his wife. And that was his, you know, fiduciary responsibility, but also was his moral responsibility. And how he was able to balance those demands of this, you know, taking on a very powerful corporation, and also still managing to carve out the moments that he did that are in the book, about finding time to still take the character to the father-daughter dance, even though he just fainted from exhaustion, or finding the time to spend time with his family, wanting to, not have this trial be all-consuming. And it was. I mean, it took years. But always trying to find the moments where he could just be a father. And that, to me, really was, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is because as powerful and as important as the work that my dad was doing in the character, and I tried to create in the character this guy who also just wanted to be a really good dad and a really good husband. And that's a hard balance when you have a lot of people conspiring against you. I mean, our phones were tapped and where he was followed, and, you know, we had all kinds of adventures that we didn't even understand were happening, except that there was a lot of static on the phone. And we didn't know why. And then we found out later that it was being tapped and his offices were tapped. So he had to do a lot of, you know, it was not a normal, straightforward legal story. He had to really be smarter and outthink them and really outthink the corporate lawyers that were trying to get control of the money. And at the same time, he still found time to be a dad. And that, I think, was like, wow, how did he do that? And how did he handle that stress? And it was an amazing. And it's really, to me, a love letter to my dad.
Yes, right, exactly. The response from other family members, what's that been like? Others that sort of knew the story and then have read the book and find it fascinating. What's the response been within the family?
Well, it's been really funny. My sister, who's the older sister in the book, she actually said, and she's a pretty accomplished woman herself, so, you know, she doesn't known for giving out compliments, but she actually said I did a really good job in describing the characters and describing the events and capturing the story. And it was a complex story that I had to make it, you know, she's a lawyer, so she understood it even better than I did. But she, you know, that was the highest praise I think I could have ever expected. It's for my sister, who lived through it too, said to me, no, you did it. You got the right story. You got the characters. You told it well. It's right on. And that was like, you're kidding. That wasn't, that was totally unexpected. And it made me beyond grateful that I wrote the story, if nothing else, for our family. And then I have other friends and colleagues and people who have maybe heard bits and pieces of the story, whether they're living in the town that, you know, the foundation that is now set up in, or if they've known about me and my family, but they're reading it. My best friends were reading it going, I didn't know this happened when you were in this little town and in the book it's called Rock Valley. I didn't know your dad was doing all that. I had no idea. And so they're just thrilled with that they knew someone who lived this story, but they're also thrilled that those parts of their childhood are now captured too. The vignettes about the small town life, and it really was kind of idyllic. And now it was sort of, it's a good counterpoint to the gentleness of the small town life against the grit and the danger of the big city. And it's another point of contrast. And my friends are like, I had no idea you were going through that. I had no idea that happened to you. Wow. And then they all want more books, you know, when they're writing the next one. So, that, you know, to me, that's the best reaction is I did tell the story well. And I know I did my dad proud.
Which is really, again, terrific. Did you want to share maybe an excerpt from the book for our audience? That would be fantastic.
Sure, it's in the prologue. It's right, and this is really how things happen. So the characters are Colin and Ruth, his wife, and they have two daughters, and they're at Disneyland in the 1960s, and they've just had their first wonderful day of a vacation, and they're going to get ready to go four more days of wonder out in the California sun, and this is what happens. An hour before dawn, the back telephone jangled on the hotel table across the room. It was 5 o'clock in the morning, and the girls were still asleep in the double bed next to him. Colin jumped up, hoping that the ringing wouldn't wake them. It had been challenging enough getting Kristen to sleep last night. She was so excited about meeting Winnie the Pooh. Hello? Yes, this is Colin Ford, he answered softly. Who could be calling him at this hour? His parents back home knew they'd be asleep, even though it was already 7 o'clock. Dan Myers here, Colin covered up the receiver with his hand, hoping to stifle Dan's bellowing voice. You need to come home immediately. Alex Hughes died last night in Florida. His will is filed first thing Monday morning in probate court. It's a real mess. Mrs. Hughes may lose everything, the foundation and her inheritance. I tried to get him to rewrite the will, but he died before we could execute it properly. What are you talking about? What's wrong with the will? I don't understand. He stretched out his lean frame against the table. A minute later, he said, okay, I'll call the Pan Am desk and book the first flight back I can. But what's going on? I'll explain it when you get here. Now hurry. Colin hung up the phone and looked around the darkened room at his slumbering family. So much for another day in the California sun, he thought to himself. Now he had to go back to the winter storms of Chippewa. What did Dan mean about Alex's will? And if Alex was dead, then what about the foundation? He wondered if he even had a job anymore. Questions swirled about him as he walked to the bed and sat down next to Ruth, reluctant to wake her and disturb her dreams. What a way to end a family vacation.
Yeah.
Can you imagine having a job and starting a new job and your boss just drops dead? And you're starting a new
right.
job that in a place your wife doesn't want to move to?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I mean, yeah. There was a general manager of a TV station that I worked for that he brought me from one state to the next and hired me, brought me into the TV studio, and then he passed of cancer 3 months after he hired me, which was very sad, but nothing where, you know, it was like that, where it was sudden and people didn't want to move or any of that. So really, I mean, it's like, this is what they call a page turner. This is the kind of thing where, you know, people are sort of really glued to it, and it's riveting. But the thing is, the fact that there's, you know, it's fictional, yet it's based on what really went on, you know, in your world. And it's like, it's extraordinary, you know, on so many different levels, too, for the reader, but also, you know, for you, too. This book also, I want to make mention, the audiobook narrated by Dallas. Tell us about that too. That's quite exciting.
Oh, Dallas SQ, he did such a great job. So when I got done with the final print version, I'm self-published, so I'm learning this whole thing. I'm learning all the things I now know. It's a big deal to learn all that stuff. So I thought to myself, you know, I can't say goodbye. Can't say goodbye to the book. I think there's more versions of it. So I went and found Dallas through Findaway Voices, and I auditioned a couple different narrators. But he somehow, I don't know how he does it, but he is so well, he's so good at this, that he actually captures the exasperation in Ruth's voice when she's dealing with the six-year-old. He captures the accents and the inflections of the small town, of the people that live in the small town Rock Valley. He captures my father, or the Colin Ford's, determination in his quiet way of speaking, the other characters. I mean, he just, and then he also narrates the scenic parts and the descriptions perfectly. So it's a really compelling audiobook. And whenever I get kind of homesick or nostalgic, I'll listen to some of the chapters, and it's like my book has come to life and my characters are there interacting. And it's so exciting for a writer to have that experience. It's almost as good as a movie.
You are absolutely, and it's shortlisted for several literary prizes too. Tell us about that. It's already, the fanfare and the buzz is already underway.
I've written it, and I've gotten it's funny because I, you know, as again, I'm self-published, so I don't know anything, I'm learning, but I entered it in some contests, and then I'd forget that I did, and then I get a notification saying, oh, you're long-listed, oh, you're short-listed, oh, and you're in the top five, and I'm like, you're kidding. So I did it mostly just to reaffirm that maybe I had a book that was worth reading, but when people who are professional readers, you know, people who read books for contests actually say, no, it's good, then I'm like, wow, I must have done something right. So, and I'll continue to look for ways. I want to get the audiobook nominated because I think my narrator deserves an award for taking this book and making it come alive. But and I'm continuing to enter it and, you know, continuing to promote it. But it's, as you said at the top, it's a passion project. And I'm really glad that I did it. But it was the right time, too. I had a family, so I couldn't exactly spend as much time working on it when, you know, 20 years ago, but now I can really put some effort and time. And it's like another child. You want it to go out and be successful in the world.
It really is, right? And the characters become, you know, very protective of the characters as well, and the storyline. I do want to let folks know that if they would like to learn about the book, get more information, they can visit KJ and then hyphen or dash writes. That's WRITES.com. That's KJ, that's the letter K, the letter J, and then hyphen or dash, and then the word writes.com. The book is also available for purchase at Amazon as well, which is quite exciting, and it is available right now for you to grab and hold on to and enjoy.
And
there's also
and the
a lot more, right?
Everywhere.
And the audiobook
is audiobook
everywhere,
is,
too.
Yeah, everywhere.
Kindle, you can get it via
Kindle. I'm running a special price this week for the audiobook. So anywhere you could buy an audiobook, it's there.
It's available.
At a discount. And it's a fun listen. It really is. And then, you know, and this is setting the stage up for, I did deliberately set it up for a sequel, because who doesn't like sequels in this world, right?
Yes. Have you already started writing that, or is that...
That's going to be next year. That's my next project next year. But I have the story. It's, again, based, fictionalized, based on what happens after Colin and Ruth live this adventure and they move to Florida, and what happens now. And believe it or not, people are still greedy wherever they go. And so the second story, again, rooted in real life adventures, has to do with kidnapping a plot that actually my sister and I were not kidnapped, but we were certainly under protection, and the FBI had to come in and rescue and arrest the guy. So that's the basis of the story. And as a kid, you can imagine, I'm 11, 12 years old, and I'm like, what do you mean people want to kidnap me? I mean, I thought we were done with all that when we moved. And so I said, my parents never sheltered me from anything, so I probably had a little bit more of a front row seat to some of these things that I wanted. But, hey, it made for great stories.
Yes, exactly right. And again, it's really fascinating when you think about it because, you know, there's so much truth in it. And, you know, character development sometimes can be a difficult situation. Did that come easy for you to develop the characters because you had so much rich material to play off of?
Well, it was and it wasn't. Some of the characters I completely fictionalized because I didn't know them and, you know, and we had way too many lawyers involved. So I fictionalized some of the characters and invented some of the scenarios just in order to tell the story. So some of the characters were completely of my fabrication, and ironically, some people tell me those are the best chapters in the book, the people I completely invented. And I'm like, really? So, but the other part was I also had to kind of make sure that I didn't make the hero, Colin, too good. I mean, he had to have flaws. And I didn't make Ruth too bad and be, you know, seen as just a cloying, clingy person. So it was kind of a balance of, yes, I have these real people, but I want to make them better versions of what they were in the book. So you had to kind of develop, I had to develop a little bit of how much do I say and how much don't I say. And then my other fun part was my grandparents, both who were both lawyers in the small town, they're in the book too because they're very important in the beginning. And I had heard all these stories about my grandfather, so some of them made him into the book. He was a judge, and he was a very influential person in our lives. But he was also a really good point of comic relief, so we have some of that into too. But so it's a melding of reality, but also making it, you know, nobody's perfect, nobody's an angel, and nobody's a devil. And the bad guy, he was pretty close to a devil, but even he has some redeeming qualities. So it was sort of developing a story where there are nuances, and as much as you may not like one of the characters, or you may love one of the characters, you know that they're not perfect, and that's just like human beings. And that's what I think that was the challenge, was not make it, you know, too idealistic.
Absolutely right. The book is Grit and Granite, a novel, again, available in paperback, audiobook, Kindle as well. We're speaking with Arthur Catherine Johnson, really, again, a riveting book. And I think, you know, as Catherine says, in today's world, we need a story where good does indeed triumph over greed. And she wanted to tell this story because it demonstrates that powerful men don't always win, and that being a force for good really does pay off. This has been a passion of hers for 25 years. It's come to fruition. Very excited about it. And again, it is available at Amazon. You can go right to Amazon to get your copy. More information about the book as well, you can visit kj-rights.com as well. And then again, her other website for her consulting group is johnsonconsults.com as well. Congratulations again, Catherine, on this fantastic book. And we look forward to more from you as well. And thanks for spending time with me and sharing it here on the show today. It was terrific.
Thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate your thoughtful questions, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed sharing my book with you. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. And again, congratulations. Self-publishing is not as easy as it seems, and you did it. So kudos to you. Catherine Johnson joining us again. The book Grit and Granite, you can find it at Amazon. Jim Masters here, thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, stay tuned. We'll be back momentarily with another amazing guest right here on Close Up Radio. Till then, for all of us, have a great day, and bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.